From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. You know, I hadn't used my umbrella in a few days. Today I had to use it when I walked outside to get something to eat outside of KPCC. Found out it didn't work. So take some advice from someone that needed it today. Check your umbrella. Make sure it all works. Coming up a little later in the show today, one of NASA's rovers ends its historic run.
Our beloved opportunity remains silent.
We'll talk to a Jet Propulsion Lab research scientist about saying goodbye to the 15-year-old Opportunity Mars rover. First, though, water. In his first State of the State address, California Governor Gavin Newsom made a lot of proclamations that took a few of us by surprise, including this one.
I do not support the water fix as currently configured, meaning I do not support the twin tunnels.
The water fix was Governor Jerry Brown's big infrastructure idea, twin tunnels that would more efficiently deliver water from the northern part of the state to Southern California. Newsom does not want to scrap the project entirely, but he would like to scale it down to one tunnel. Here to talk about what all this means, we turn to Dale Kasler of the Sacramento Bee. He writes a lot about water issues in the state. Dale, welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you.
All right. First off, what has Governor Newsom's administration told you about why one tunnel is the better way to go on this water fix plan? Is it just about money?
No, not really, although money, I think, does play into it. But they believe that the smaller footprint will make it easier to get through the remaining permits, environmental reviews, and so on. And now Governor Newsom did say last fall that he thought that one tunnel versus two would tamp down some of the fears in Northern California that this whole project is nothing but a water grab by the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. It remains to be seen. I think there's still a lot of opposition up here to the project, whether it's one tunnel or two.
Yeah, Dale, we're going to be hearing from the Metropolitan Water District in just a few minutes. But on costs, though, one tunnel will be cheaper. But by how much, Dale?
Well, interesting question, because last spring, Governor Brown's administration talked about downsizing the project to one tunnel. They thought it could save about $5 billion. So take it from a $16, $17 billion project down to the $11 or $12 billion figure. And then when Metropolitan stepped in and wrote a bigger check, suddenly the two-tunnel approach was back on track. So clearly there are some savings, although the governor did not mention that yesterday.
Now, given, though, that now this is a different project than what was originally proposed, does that mean that breaking ground on this thing will be delayed even longer?
I would think so. They have several proceedings going on, including a big one before the State Water Board, where they basically need a permit in order to divert water out of the Sacramento River to feed into the tunnels. And now that this is a different project, I don't think they necessarily have to start from scratch, but they are going to have to retool their application to the State Water Board, and I think that takes some time. Newsom's administration is downplaying that issue. They think, well, this is a simpler, smaller project. This is going to simplify things. This will make things go quicker. But I got to believe there's some additional delay in all this.
Speaking of Dale Kasler of the Sacramento Bee, now, Dale, the other big announcement relating to all this is that Newsom named a new chair of the State Water Resources Control Board, which works with the governor to set water policy in the state. Tell us who's in charge now and how people are reacting to this.
Well, the new chair is going to be Joaquin Esquivel, who has worked for the state, the Natural Resources Agency. He's worked for former Senator Barbara Boxer. He's been on the State Water Board for about 2 years. He will replace Felicia Marcus, who has been the chair since 2013. And she was seen as, I guess, somewhat of a divisive figure. She certainly had very few supporters in the farm community and in agriculture, and clearly the governor is trying to retool that somewhat.
Yeah, Dale, let's hear a little bit more from Gavin Newsom on that.
We need to meet the needs of cities and farms. We have got to get past these old binaries, like farmers versus environmentalists, the North versus South. Our approach can't be either or. It has to be yes and.
Dale, it seems as if Newsom is signaling a centrist approach here. Does that sound fair to you?
I guess. I think so as well. It may be more that Felicia Marcus had become just so identified with the environmental community. She used to work for the Natural Resources Defense Council, that she just was no longer seen as somebody who could occupy the middle ground. and perhaps Esquivel could. We'll see where that goes. We'll see how much difference is being made with the new chair.
Dale, you know this. For the longest time, it's kind of been a fish versus farmer argument here. So in the end, I mean, will the fish win out?
Well, who knows? I mean, I think, you know, either way, you're going to see more water devoted to fish and less water available for farms and cities. It's just a question of degree. Ultimately, this compromise plan or some version of this compromise plan that Governor Brown put on the table in December is likely to become reality. I mean, Governor Newsom endorsed this proposal yesterday. Environmentalists generally don't like the settlement plan. They think it doesn't provide nearly enough water for the fish. And they say you can do all you want with habitat restoration, and that's all well and good, but the fish need more water, a lot more water. In fact, they say that even the amount of water that Felicia Marcus was giving to the fish wasn't enough. And to scale it back on a compromise plan really just is paying lip service to the environmental concerns.
That's Dale Kasler at the Sacramento Bee talking about the governor's decision to scale down a plan to build two tunnels to deliver water across the state. Dale, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, you heard our previous guest mention the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. It's made up of more than two dozen water agencies down here and was a big proponent of Governor Jerry Brown's two-tunnel plan for the water fix. Last year, MWD agreed to kick in $10.8 billion to make the twin tunnels a reality. But now that the current governor, Gavin Newsom, wants to scale it back to one tunnel, we want to know what that means for us here in Southern California. Jeffrey Keitlinger is general manager of the Metropolitan Water District. Jeffrey, welcome back.
Good afternoon, eh?
All right. Thanks for being back. Now, Jeffrey, I understand Governor Newsom called you right before he made his plans clear to the public yesterday. What was your first reaction?
We talked several times before he rolled it out, and I certainly got a chance, an opportunity to work with his resources secretary and some of his other staff on the issue. So, you know, it wasn't a shock or surprise. We had a number of detailed discussions. But, you know, we weren't thrilled by it. We honestly believe the best thing for California and a climate change world is to build something of sufficient capacity to really capture storm flows. We're going to see much more rain, not snow, and we're just going to have to move water quickly. That said, he said it's better to get something built in this time frame than nothing at all. And his analysis and his take on that was that there simply wasn't enough support, enough agricultural financing, enough partners to get Governor Brown's twin tunnel project built, and it needed to be scaled back.
Jeffrey, I'll admit, even in all of our conversations we've had on this in the past, you've always kind of said that, well, you know, two tunnels is cool, but if it comes down to one, we can make that work too. How much of a difference will it be?
You know, it'll be a big difference for parts of the state that don't have other resources available to them, because for many parts of the state, this is their exclusive supply, and having that scaled back means that they have less reliability. Larger is going to be better in a climate change world. That said, and Southern California, we're lucky in the sense we have the Colorado River supplies. City of Los Angeles has some supply out of Owens Valley. We've developed some ocean desal, a lot of groundwater recycling, a lot of other programs, a lot of groundwater capture and stormwater capture. So down here, this isn't going to be a devastating blow to Southern California because we have a lot of options, but it is going to be harder in other parts of the state.
Jeffrey, remind us why you think this project is so important for L.A. water customers.
What's really critical is Southern California gets 30% of its water supply from Northern California, and that's a huge number when you think of the 19 million people we have in Southern California. And that water has become more and more driven by climate change to become rainfall. And our system was built for a slow melting snowpack over the years. It wasn't meant to capture large gulps of rain that comes down in 48 or 72 hours. And that's the world we're moving into this last decade. And that's where you need something like a large tunnel that can pick it up and move it and get it into reservoirs. And so this really was an adaptation approach to a changing climate that we're wrestling with. We've all been seeing this last decade. 8 of the last 10 years in California have been dry. You know, kind of fortunate we got some rain right now, but This is the world we're moving to, a drier, hotter world, and we have to adapt with it.
Talking to Jeffrey Keitlinger, general manager of the Metropolitan Water District. Now, as I mentioned, you guys pledged a lot of money to get this project off the ground. How could this new plan now change your involvement?
Well, we'll be working closely with the governor's office and his administration to figure out exactly what changes are going to be made to the tunnel project. It's certainly going to be smaller, and that will mean less of a financial impact for Metropolitan. So that's on the plus side. On the negative side, we'll be looking at impacts to some water supply reliability, and we'll have to manage that and figure out what other options we pursue to make up that nut.
Wondering, Jeffrey, okay, so it was two tunnels, now it's one. Could that one tunnel be made larger, or is it going to be just one of the tunnels that was already in the works, just one of them? In terms of size, I mean.
Yes. When there was a lot of discussion, when some of the agricultural partners never realized that they realized they could not come up with the financing, there was look at shaving it down to a one-tunnel project towards the end of the Brown administration. And the concept then was build a second one maybe 25 years down the road to add to it. That concept was to build one tunnel larger than what we currently have proposed. So instead of a 20-foot barrel tunnel, maybe something on the tune of about 30 feet, and it would be like roughly two-thirds the capacity of the full two-tunnel project. Those are the refinements where you have to sit down with the Newsom administration and work out what makes the most sense right now.
Okay, so what are the next steps? You mentioned sitting down with Gavin Newsom. Any timetables for this?
No, but I think we want to do this in the next 30 days or so to get a good game plan, because we have a lot of processes that are moving forward. We're spending money on project design and some of the project protocols, and we need to figure out exactly where to go. So I think we're going to be sitting down in short order and coming up with a revised game plan. And there will be some impacts, you know, as Dale said, in terms of time and schedule, and we'll have to just see exactly what those impacts are.
Actually, really quick, Jeffrey, any year ETA, when would you like to have this done if you could make your wish list?
If I could make my wish list, we'd have this project delivering water tomorrow.
Well, I know that, Jeffrey.
But yeah, so knowing that, realistically, 2030 would be, I think, the earliest we could get this online, about a decade out.
Jeffrey Keitlinger is general manager of the Metropolitan Water District. Jeffrey, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
You know, I've always believed that whether you live next door to someone or miles away, here in L.A., we're all each other's neighbor. And neighbors help each other out. That's exactly what's happening with some folks who do not have a place to call home. They're getting help from people who are tired of waiting for local governments to fix homelessness. That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm E. Martinez. More people are homeless in California than any other state in the country. It's a crisis decades in the making, though there are now hundreds of millions of dollars of public money available to address the problem. But progress is slow. So slow that some Californians are trying to do the work themselves. As part of our California Dream collaboration, KPCC's Matt Tinoco reports.
Dorit Dalor Guerrero is walking on the bank of the LA River. She's in her 50s, grew up in Los Angeles, and is dressed in billowy clothing with a color palette that matches her flaming red hair.
Just being someone's friend. That's what all this is about.
She's walking from shantytown to shantytown, saying good morning.
Hello.
Offering supplies, snacks, and information about where the homeless locals can find a hot meal. Dorit also wants to make sure they have a plan for when the encampment cleanup, set to happen the very next day, actually happens.
So are you going to hop down there or hop over there?
Hop down there, because if you go over there, the state messes with you.
A man living in a tent nearby calls out.
For housing, do you guys help with housing?
Dorit is frustrated with the answer that she has to give. Getting this man into a nearby facility with a bed and 3 square meals a day?
It ain't going to happen, though, because it doesn't exist.
For all the talk and all the government investment, building new housing and service centers for homeless people is painfully slow. New affordable homes can take more than a decade to go up. Dorit is a co-founder of the Sela Neighborhood Homeless Coalition.
Sort of like Echo Park, Los Feliz, Atwater, Hollywood.
The group started as a band of do-gooders who wanted to get to know their homeless neighbors on a first-name basis. As she puts it,
they're just folks who see someone on the street and say, that person shouldn't be on the street. Let's do something.
Sela's members aren't homeless service workers. They're TV people, marketing people, ex-government people, grant writers. They're regular folks who have become friends with their homeless neighbors. They've learned more about life on the street, and they've realized how inadequate existing infrastructure is for what people who are homeless actually need. Over time, Sila has grown into one of the strongest advocates for the homeless in its corner of Los Angeles. Here's another co-founder, Nithya Raman.
We realized that there was a real need to not just do the outreach and get to know individuals and try and connect them to services as best we could, but also to advocate for more services within walking distance.
Today, the group is aiming to open, or at least help open, a space in the area for homeless people to access services.
We have to think about our homeless neighbors' most urgent and immediate needs, and that if we don't, it's a humanitarian crisis.
There are groups like Sila around the state, neighborhood groups in the Central Valley, the Bay Area, San Diego, who are transforming their mission from helpful neighbors to full-blown advocates and even to service providers themselves. People like Mel Tilakaratna.
We need people to come and get involved in their community.
He lives in Los Angeles now, but he grew up privileged in Sri Lanka. A few years ago, he started handing out food and tents to his unsheltered neighbors.
We need to give out tents, but why would we ever think that's enough?
Those efforts grew into a regular volunteer operation on LA's Skid Row. But he wanted to do more.
We were like, okay, how do we use our volunteer base?
So he started organizing supporters for homeless services and housing, making sure their voices are heard alongside the reactionary ones that tend to pack public meetings.
If we keep listening to the not in my backyard people, we're never going to get anything done.
He also started getting trailers and converting them into mobile showers. He operates them with a nonprofit called the Shower of Hope. It contracts with local Southern California governments to run public showers. They double as access points for homeless services. I meet him at one in Southeast LA County where the visitors are shaving and showering, and they're eating a chili verde breakfast all to a cumbia soundtrack.
We get a person every day who hasn't showered in at least a month.
He's doing it because nobody else is. Government has the money, but its wheels turn slowly. The only way it moves faster is if the public demands it.
Until they actually speak up, things are not going to change. Things are only going to get worse.
He says the humanitarian crisis unfolding across our state is inexcusable. From Los Angeles, I'm Matt Tinoco.
Bobby Cagle is the director of the Los Angeles Department of Children and Family Services. It's been just over a year since he stepped into that role, and he walked into a department that soon came under fire for the high-profile death of a child, Anthony Avalos, whose abuse had been reported to DCFS. The case, he told us late last year, had given him, quote, points of focus to deeply evaluate the system. Earlier this week, Cagle joined us again to talk about some of the changes he's tried to implement at the agency.
After that case, I had 1,000 case reviews conducted throughout the county. That put me in the direction of doing several things. First of all, looking at our voluntary family maintenance program.
What is that?
Those cases that we found concerns in the family, not such that we would remove the child immediately, but that the family agrees that they need some services. We put those in and monitor the case after that. Also, how we interview, especially interviewing children, because children are a special group of individuals and are very difficult to interview sometimes. Assessing injuries that we see, because children, of course, get injured. And we want to be able to very deftly be able to determine, is it an accidental injury or is it something that is suspicious for abuse and neglect and needs a doctor to look at?
When it came to assessing injuries, you would think, I mean, on a top level that, oh, that's easy. If they got a bruise, if they got a cut. But what were the weaknesses that were happening?
Too many things, in my estimation, were being ascribed to accidental injuries. And certainly children do get injured. But there are injuries that would lead me as a social worker to say, I need a medical evaluation on this.
What would be something that for you, and you've been a foster kid too, so you've been in the system. So what would make you think, okay, this is not just a normal injury?
One of those is a whipcord injury. It's indicative of a parent who has grabbed a cord and hit the child with a cord. It makes a looped kind of bruise. what that does for us is it sends us in the direction of having a medical professional look at that. And that is the key. It's not that our social workers have to be so good at it that they can say positively that is abuse or neglect. It has to be them looking at it and having reason to have a medical professional look at it.
How different, actually, are what you're doing now compared to a year ago, 2 years ago with the system?
My concern in looking at the training system currently is that we spend time doing these things in our initial training. I think there are certain areas like interviewing, like medical exams, that really need more training. And so we're looking at doing more and doing it repeatedly so that we can have a higher level of training given to social workers, even if they've been with us for 20 years.
Let's just say you do everything that you set out to do, but say, heaven forbid, another child dies. How do you decide and how do you figure out if the training still was successful, even if other kids are still in danger?
You know, I think this is the utility of doing these regular case reviews, making sure that we have a system to be able to detect if there are ongoing issues. So looking for those patterns in those case reviews is really how you tell if the training is taking hold and if there are things that you need to tweak or change.
All right, now moving on. Now, last September, the LA County Board of Supervisors approved plans for DCFS to partner with faith-based organizations across the county, in large part to recruit new foster parents. Bobby, how's that been going so far?
The neat thing is that that group of 300 faith leaders from around the community gave me a long list of things that they're doing that are actually primary prevention efforts to keep children and families from coming into the system at all.
What were some of those efforts that impressed you?
There is one group that really provides any kind of resource that our social workers ask for families. So there may be those families who we know are in need of beds for children.
Something as simple like beds.
Something like beds, and especially cribs. This group, for instance, brings cribs to anybody that needs it that has a financial need.
Talking to Bobby Cagle, director of the Los Angeles Department of Children and Family Services. Bobby, remember Supervisor Sheila Kuehl was supportive of these partnerships with faith-based organizations, but she was also concerned about how LGBTQ foster kids would be treated by these communities. What have you seen and heard so far?
In my career, I've seen faith-based communities that would not deal with the issue of LGBTQ. Being gay myself, it is an issue that concerns me, certainly. There is unfortunately, a negative feeling around some faith-based organizations in regard to this. But what I've found thus far is that these organizations are willing to really think about this, to see how they can better serve these kids and families, and that's what's required.
Because I would imagine one of the biggest fears would be for a faith-based organization to want to be involved with foster kids with the ultimate goal of conversion somehow.
Yes, and that is something that we guard against because we want to make sure that these kids are in loving, accepting environments. That kind of thing is something that is very injurious to kids, and we don't want to see that happen with our foster youth.
Now, the system obviously needs people willing to be foster parents. Bobby, whenever I've spoken, though, to folks who are willing to consider it, they all seem to share this one similar concern, and that's the psychological turmoil of taking in a child, bonding with that child, then wanting to adopt, but then not being able to because the biological family wants another chance. How does DCFS handle that delicate balance?
In some cases, we handle it very well. In others, I think we could improve. It is a very difficult thing because you go into these cases not knowing how it's going to end. We do know in the beginning, however, that federal law and state law require us to do reunification with the family before we rule them out.
So that's the priority.
Yes, that's okay. The priority. And so there is a real likelihood that the child will only temporarily be in the home of those foster parents. But I certainly understand the really heart-wrenching after effects for families that go in, fall in love with the child, and then have to give it up back to the family.
You mentioned how in most cases you handle it well, but in some cases you don't. When you don't, how does that look?
You know, typically it would be a very young caseworker, maybe a new caseworker who has not explained well on the front end exactly what was happening in a case. One of the worst things that we can do is to lead them to believe either through omission of information or, in some cases, not giving them information for specific reasons. Mm. If you do that, it leads them to really set their feelings up to be hurt. And I want to make sure that we're giving those families who have really done the community a service by stepping forward to give them full information, to know them, let them know exactly what to expect going forward so that we can keep them in the system and that we can keep them in the lives of the children and families that they work with.
Bobby, does a successful foster care system require a substantial amount of foster parents that never have plans to adopt? Would that help?
The studies that have looked at this say that you need 3 foster parents for every child in foster care in your system. What we want to do is to make sure that we have enough foster parents, and sometimes that means that you have to have a surplus. You'll have families that don't have children in their homes. Mm-hmm. We actually recruit more than we need because we have to have possibilities for children that really give us an opportunity to make a good match, both for the family and for the child.
All right, Bobby, it seems like we always just talk to you about some of the tougher things that are going on in the system, but what else in terms of your plans for 2019, what else do you have planned for this year? And what things have you been proud of in your time here?
The really neat thing is that we're coming up on a strategic plan rollout, and it will have 4 areas of focus, including making sure that we're recruiting, retaining, and training the best. Also, services to children, youth, and families, an analysis of where we have the services we need versus where we don't. Also, community and cross-sector partnerships, just like the faith community initiatives that you're talking about. I want to develop those kind of relationships in every community in LA County. But I think the key for the public to understand is I come every day to work, and I expect my staff to, with an idea of improving on everything that we do so that we do better each and every day.
That's Bobby Cagle, Director of the Los Angeles Department of Children and Family Services. Bobby, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This year's Oscars telecast is going to be wildly different than what you're used to. First off, no host. No one will be doing a monologue or a song, working in some jokes at the expense of the nominees in the crowd. And then about those nominees, when some of them become Oscar winners, they might not get as much screen time as they've had in the past. Around the U.S., most people probably don't care or notice. But this is L.A. Hollywood's our business here, and a lot of people are not happy with this. Find out why when Take Two continues. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The Academy of Motion Pictures faces backlash after announcing it won't present certain categories during the Oscars telecast. Plus, the release of Captain Marvel is just around the corner. It's Marvel's first film with a female lead. So, what took the studio so long? Let's go on the lot.
Hey, God, I wish you'd
stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
The Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan is our guide, as always. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, A.
All right, Rebecca. 24 film categories are presented at the Oscars. On Monday, the Academy announced that 4 of those categories will be presented during commercial breaks.
Here are the 4 men and the 1 trailblazing woman who are nominated for Achievement in Cinematography.
Now, here are the nominees for Best Live Action Short Film.
It is now my honor to present this year's nominees for Achievement in Film Editing.
Here are the year's nominees for Achievement in Makeup and Hairstyle.
Rebecca, why those 4 in particular?
Well, 6 branches volunteered to be the guinea pigs this year for this new process, including the branch of the Academy's president, John Bailey, who's a cinematographer and who's had the responsibility of selling this idea to his membership. My colleague, Carolyn Gherardina, reported that the branches were shown a demo video of how exactly this would work. Essentially, what's cut out is their walk to the stage. And if their speech gets very long and full of names, that may be trimmed as well. I think it's no accident that these are categories that tend to be free of the movie stars that cause people to tune in for the Oscars. Of course, they would never take like Best Actress and put that during a commercial break.
No. So how are people responding to this decision?
Not well, eh? The move has been roundly condemned by filmmakers like Guillermo del Toro, Patty Jenkins, Alfonso Cuarón, also actors like Russell Crowe, Seth Rogen, Alec Baldwin, and IATSE, which is the union that represents many of the people in these categories, has condemned it. So it's been pretty unpopular. I will say, though, that most of the people who are upset about it have not seen the sample video that the Academy showed to some of its members to give them a sense of what it would look like. You will still, if you win the Oscar for Best Cinematography, you will still appear on the telecast. It will just be later. It won't be live as it happens. Yeah. It will be edited down.
I got a feeling, Rebecca, that this is one of those things that, sure, in LA, an industry town, people will be all upset about, maybe New York as well, but maybe in other places in the country, I don't know if people are going to care too much.
Well, that's the central dilemma of the Oscars, that it is that it's a show that has to serve the intense cineast audience, as well as a big, broad audience that watches a big network like ABC. I mean, this is a show that last year drew the lowest ratings in its history, and that's a problem for the Academy. So they're trying to make adjustments and keep those big audiences that they've had in the past.
If this works really well and they get past any controversy, is this a sign of things to come?
Well, it may be. You might recall over a decade ago, the Academy took the Governor's Awards out of the main telecast and made them a separate event that happens in the fall. It was hugely controversial at the time, and that event has evolved into being one of the sort of marquee events of award season. People forget that anyone was upset about it. So it is possible that this too shall pass.
All right, let's move on now to some news about Woody Allen. He had a film deal with Amazon. The studio moved to cancel it. Why?
Amazon signed this giant deal with Allen in August of 2017. And in October of 2017, the Harvey Weinstein stories broke. And I don't think it's overstating things to say that the world changed, particularly with regard to how it views men who have allegations of any kind of sexual misconduct against them. In the case of Woody Allen, the allegations are decades old, but this sort of new climate led Amazon to feel that they could not release the film that they had in the can, nor honor the deal that had multiple films set to be made. They said audiences have changed and actors have changed in terms of their willingness to work with Allen, and so they opted to try and close the deal.
So they can do that, though. I mean, they can go ahead and just end it.
Well, Woody Allen's lawyers say no, they can't. That there's nothing that was revealed about Woody Allen after this deal that Amazon didn't know when they went into it. Interestingly, the executive who signed this deal with Woody Allen, his name is Roy Price, is no longer at Amazon. He, too, ended up leaving the company amid Me Too allegations. So there's a new executive who came in, Jennifer Salke, with a regime to really change the culture at Amazon, and it appears that not honoring its Woody Allen deal is part of that.
All right, let's move on now to a movie that I am really looking forward to.
So you have superhuman strength, and you can shoot lasers from your hands. Is there anything I'm missing?
Congratulations, Agent Fury. You have finally asked a relevant question. Watch this.
Rebecca, you spoke to Brie Larson for the cover of this week's Hollywood Reporter. What did she tell you about this iconic role that she's taken on?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This is the first Marvel movie to be fronted by a woman. There have been 20 movies in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, none where it was a female character in the title and at the forefront. I thought Brie Larson would be sort of jumping up and down about that. She was reluctant to have me put it in that historical context. she feels like, hey, women have been opening movies since the very beginning, since the silent film era, and everybody just sort of acts each time like this is, wow, can she do it? Can a woman actually open a movie? She didn't want to sort of overstate those stakes. I still think it's very significant, and I think Marvel thinks so too.
It's coming out almost two whole years after DC's Wonder Woman, so I'm wondering what took so long.
Well, I did ask Kevin Feige, who is the head of Marvel Studios, why did it take so long? And, you know, his first answer to that was, look, there are going to be a lot more. This is going to be the first of many female-fronted Marvel movies. He also pointed out that sort of assembling the characters who were in the Avengers required making a number of movies that were male characters. But he also pointed out, too, they first announced this movie 4 years ago. It's been a long time coming. First announced it, by the way, the same day that they announced Black Panther, which was another really groundbreaking movie culturally and for the studio.
All right. Now, Brie Larson, you mentioned, pretty active in the Time's Up movement. What did she tell you about that and how it correlates to this particular role?
Well, one thing that was interesting was that as Brie was preparing to play this role, which is a very physical one where she was spending a lot of time in the gym, weightlifting, learning judo, she was also building Time's Up. She was one of the really kind of formative early members. Some of the early meetings were held at her home. And she found these two processes, the physical workout and the sort of emotional workout of building Time Up, very complementary and very similar. She says Time's Up sort of taught her how to express herself in a meeting. She said, you know, this when I was really learning how to bang my hand on a coffee table and say, you need to listen to me. At the same time that she was getting ready to play this very physically powerful character.
All right, Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk about the latest news with the show business industry. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
You can hear more about the Oscars controversy coming up at 3:30 on The Frame with John Horn. Now, when a lot of us were teenagers, we probably had no idea what we wanted to do when we grew up. I was debating between center fielder for the Dodgers or movie star, didn't have a prayer with either. Coming up next, we'll meet someone who as a teen seemed to make Mars her target, then hit the bullseye. She's next when Take Two continues. Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. All right, be honest. When was the last time you took a quiz on BuzzFeed or checked out one of its top 10 lists? You probably found yourself reading some of its more serious news stories, too. Well, reporters in the BuzzFeed newsroom voted to unionize on Tuesday. The vote comes after the popular website laid off 15% of its workforce last month. To find out what this signals for BuzzFeed and news outlets everywhere, we have NPR media correspondent and host of NPR's On Point, David Folkenflik. David, welcome back to Take Two.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I should say that KPCC, just for full disclosure, is a unionized newsroom. More than 90% of the BuzzFeed newsroom voted to unionize yesterday. What does that say to you?
I think it says that there's insecurity about the direction of BuzzFeed, as successful as it's been in many ways, and that people are looking for some protection. Question about both fairness and compensation and working conditions, and also just job security, knowing that things will play out in a fair-handed way. You know, there's some pretty significant layoffs in recent weeks at BuzzFeed, but this was in the works prior to that as people were looking down the line, seeing the demands of the past investors in BuzzFeed and hoping their jobs would not be in peril as a result.
Now, for BuzzFeed's employees, what were they lobbying for?
My sense is that they wanted a greater sense of, shall we say, parity in terms of pay among employees doing similar work. They wanted parity in pay in terms of people doing similar work to people at other companies that may have been being paid better. And they wanted, for example, there was this dynamic that played out among the recent layoffs in which people felt that it was sort of announced that there would be layoffs, but not made clear how they would operate. And so people sort of walked around feeling as though there was this anvil over their heads the entire time. And management conceded things weren't done in a good way. You would have a much more scripted process if you had a union representing workers there.
And one of the things with unionization, that means typically better salaries, benefits maybe that didn't exist before. And the company has to figure out how to finance all this. So I know a lot of legacy newsrooms have decided to charge for their digital product to help pay for the cost of just doing business in 2018, 2019. Do you think BuzzFeed might have to adopt that model eventually?
I think they're trying to figure out what they're doing. You know, I think that it's not that BuzzFeed isn't profitable. It's that the expectation set by the venture capitalists who put some real significant money in there early on, creating expectations and demands for increasing levels of profit, have made BuzzFeed's finances look problematic, which is not to say that BuzzFeed's not getting significant revenues. It's that it's not at the level that they wanted. And when you accept a certain degree of venture capital, it may mean you're not in full control of your destiny. I find it hard to say that, you know, news organizations are putting in paywalls because they have union contracts as opposed to not having union contracts. I think news organizations are putting in paywalls, at least the legacy ones, because of the evaporation, effectively, of classified advertising and other kinds of display ads that really used to be the lion's share of their revenues. And so they're relying much more heavily on print subscription to underwrite what they do. And then they say, well, let's look to some of our betters. You know, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, particularly the New York Times has done very well with digital subscriptions. Let's cash in on that. Mm-hmm. That's hard to do if you work for a news organization that has obvious peers or that isn't considered indispensable by its readers. I don't know how much BuzzFeed readers would be wanting to read, you know, 15 things you never knew about Ross and Rachel, or, you know, 117 ways in which Brexit is like Riverdale. You know, like, yeah. I don't know what it does. On the other hand, BuzzFeed also has an increasingly sophisticated news operation, and it's not clear that that's going to be financially viable. And so there's been questions as they start to differentiate the BuzzFeed News brand from the BuzzFeed brand, whether in some ways that's going to be spun off, sold outright, really cut down, or, you know, in some other ways cauterized from affecting the bottom line of the larger BuzzFeed, which, you know, has a varieties of revenue streams that seem to be working even as they're desperately trying to keep up. You know, BuzzFeed was doing incredibly well until Facebook essentially decided to retweak the algorithms and knocked its traffic down significantly. And that was a terrible blow.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. He's also host of NPR's On Point. David, thanks a lot.
You bet.
All right, now to a story about saying goodbye. It's not often that someone as a teenager gets to witness the genesis of a huge scientific project, then 15 years later, watch it end, this time as a scientist working on that very same project. That is Abigail Freeman's story. She was 16 years old when she was visiting the Jet Propulsion Laboratory when the rover Opportunity landed on Mars. And eventually, she became the deputy project scientist on that rover. Thing is, all that ended today as the team ended attempts to communicate with Opportunity. Dr. Abigail Freeman, welcome to Take Two.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Now, you're a person of science, so you know all about the inevitability of things coming eventually to an end. But today, sad day or just what was expected?
Yeah, I'd say it's a bit of a bittersweet day. You know, it's sad because we're ending a mission that's been a part of our lives for 15 years. And as you mentioned, particularly important in setting the course of my life. But
that's crazy, too. I mean, teenager, you see it and then all of a sudden you're still doing it 15 years later. Yeah,
but certainly a celebration of how much we've accomplished. And, you know, from day one, the goal was to run this mission until we couldn't do it anymore, either by driving it into the ground or having Mars kill it for us. And the latter is what happened. So the fact that we ended through an act of Mars rather than an act of us is remarkable and something to be so proud of.
Almost ideal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You weren't responsible. The planet was.
Right.
Yeah. Now it's okay. So you were the deputy project scientist. What was your role there?
Yeah. So my role is to kind of interface between the science and the engineering team. So for our rover, most of the engineers are located at JPL here in Southern California, but the science team members are all over the country and all over the world. So I'm kind of a representative at JPL, so I can help interface with the engineers and the science teams. And that's one of the things that makes this mission so special is the relationship between the engineers and the scientists. It's really that coordination that I think has allowed us to have such an extraordinary mission over the last 15 years.
Would you say you had a relationship with Opportunity, the rover itself, in a weird way? I know it's an inanimate object and everything.
Yeah, you know, I really think I do. It's something when you think about it for so long and you spend your whole career working on making this rover safe, thinking about what she saw, you really do start to anthropomorphize the rover and think about, you know, this is a vehicle that we rode on the surface of Mars, and that's really special.
Now, what kinds of things did Opportunity reveal about Mars 15 years later?
So many science discoveries that we've made over the last 15 years. But I think the highlights, first of all, Opportunity provided the first definitive evidence that Mars's past was very different and supported liquid water. And that's important in understanding how the climate of Mars has changed and also thinking about whether or not life could ever have arisen on Mars. We know life needs liquid water. And the fact that we now have evidence Mars supported it is a good sign that there might be life on Mars. Since then, we've we've been able to do a lot of work characterizing. There's been multiple episodes of liquid water. The water itself had very different chemistry. From later in Mars's history, it was really acidic. To earlier in history, it was probably a lot more friendly to life, neutral pH water that you could drink. So just piecing together this whole story along 28 miles of traverse has been, it's so much fun, and we've learned so much.
That's so awesome. We're talking to Dr. Abigail Freeman, research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Why did Opportunity have to die?
Why? That's a good question. but the physics of it, I guess you could say, it has to do with the fact that Opportunity was a solar paneled rover. We got our energy from the sun. And the thinking was this mission was only supposed to last for 3 months. So the engineers designed the solar panels to be big enough for 3 months, assuming dust accumulated on them over time. But what happened was it lasted much longer, in part because it was just so well built, and in part because we got these periodic gusts of winds that would actually clean the solar panels. Mars helped us out and clean the rover. But last June, a giant dust storm popped up, and Mars has these periodic planet-wide dust storms that happened. We weathered one back in 2007, but the one that started this past June was just so much more ferocious than anything we've seen. And the dust storm blocked the sun, and it kept us from getting energy on our solar panels and recharging the battery. And that's what made us lose communication with the rover.
So, but is it, I mean, you guys can't check back in 6 weeks, 6 months, 6 years, if the sun hits it again, I don't know.
Yeah, so that's what we've been trying. So after the dust storm abated, we've spent over 1,000 commands trying to say, hey, are you there? You know, in a perfect world, the fault protection software kicked in. The rover went through an orderly shutdown. And when she gets enough sunlight on her panel, she'll wake up and say, I'm here. I'm ready to do more science. But what probably happened was something either drained the battery a little bit more than could have supported further communication, or perhaps there was just too much dust that settled on the solar panels after this massive storm, and there was no way that we would hear from Opportunity again. And we're now heading into the winter season, so we've kind of passed the window where we had the best chance to hear from Opportunity the summertime with the most sun and the best temperatures.
That is a doornail, right?
Yeah.
So what are you going to do next, Doctor?
Oh, well, fortunately, there's a lot going on in Mars exploration still. So I'm a member of the Curiosity rover team, which is
Sweet.
The follow-on rover. Yeah. And we're just having a blast exploring Mount Sharp and Gale Crater. We're seeing evidence for ancient lakes. We found organic molecules that are the building blocks of life. And beyond that, we're busy getting ready for our next rover that's going to launch in 2020. That's actually going to go and collect samples from a site that we think has a really high probability that if there ever was life on Mars, here's where we'd find
it. Doctor, we're going to pencil you in for when you find it, all right? That's Dr. Abigail Freeman, research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Doctor, thanks a lot.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Opportunity came to my door. All right, you can always find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. While you're there, why don't you follow me as well? I'm at AMartinezLA, AMartinezLA. That's Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2:00.